it just so happened, as things evolved, glyphosate became the most widely used herbicide in the world. Nobody was looking at what was going on in soil biology. We have all these assumptions. You know, you'll hear it from the companies, and you'll hear it from many scientists that says glyphosate is inactivated when it hits the soil. It's neutralized, microbes degrade it. Well, that is not always true. We know that it affects soil biology. It is becoming prevalent in surface waters because it's running off fields that has been receiving glyphosate for the last 15 to 18 years, and it's beginning to build up.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts for today, Greta Anderson, together with Gail Seiler. Hello, Gail. Thanks for joining me today.
The topic of today's show is glyphosate, a word that Greta taught me how to pronounce.
Glyphosate, the active ingredient of Roundup and the most widely used pesticide in the world.
Later in the show, we will bring you Sue Dinsdale of Iowa Citizens Action Network, one of the groups putting on tomorrow's Working Families Summit in Ames, which features Speaker Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. But for now, the word of the hour is
glyphosate. This is a chemical that's used on upwards of 90% of all farm fields in Iowa, sometimes multiple times, thanks to its linkage with Monsanto's Roundup Ready crops. These are genetically modified crops, or GMOs, which are genetically engineered to resist glyphosate, theoretically making it easy to weed huge fields with a single application. Meanwhile, glyphosate, which American farmers now apply to the tune of 128,000 tons per year, has been showing up everywhere. Not just in farmers' urine, but in mother's milk. Not just in grain exports and cattle feed, but in products like honey and soy sauce. According to the Environmental Working Group blog, a paper coming out next month in the journal Food Chemistry has Norwegian scientists reporting, quote, extreme levels of glyphosate, unquote, on genetically modified or Roundup Ready soy. Here's what the Environmental Working Group says. What it boils down to is this. Every time we eat genetically engineered soy, we are taking a dose of Roundup with it.
In addition, in March, the World Health Organization declared glyphosate a probable carcinogen, linking it to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a disease that has been on the rise in recent decades.
At least in part because of suggestive findings such as these, glyphosate has been banned recently in countries as widespread as the Netherlands, Sri Lanka, and El Salvador, temporarily banned for use in France, and is under serious scrutiny in Brazil. Russia has banned the planting of all genetically modified organisms, such as Roundup Ready crops. And this one is interesting. The Chinese government has decided that its army will no longer be consuming genetically modified grains.
With the closure of all of these markets, it's not surprising that some farmers are switching back to conventional practices this year. Farmers can get about $2 more a bushel for non-GMO soy and 35 cents a bushel more for non-GMO corn. And the few relatively small businesses that deal in this commodity have reported being flooded with inquiries.
With us in the studio is a certified crop advisor from Boone, Iowa, who has been encouraging his clients to make this switch from GMO to non-GMO for several reasons. Interestingly, he does his consulting work both in the northern and southern hemisphere, keeping him busy year-round, of course, and also better apprised of the global trends. We'll be talking with him as this segment progresses. We'll also talk to the director of research of the Iowa Soybean Association, Ed Anderson.
With all of this glyphosate floating around in the environment, the question of whether or how glyphosate affects those who consume it, meaning humans who consume it or ingest it, is also an important one.
And I hope to cover that in a future show, Gail. What interests me now for this show and what we're going to explore is how glyphosate affects the crops themselves and the soil they grow in. There's government pushback and market pushback, but how is nature itself pushing back against this deluge of glyphosate? So let's rewind the tape and start back at the beginning of Roundup. I checked in with Mark Rasmussen, the director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, and asked him to provide our listeners a kind of introduction to the Roundup story. He was unable to be here in person, but he was gracious, and we had a very nice discussion.
Interestingly, it started out as a compound being studied by Monsanto for water softeners because it's a strong chelator. That is, it binds strongly with certain ions that, like in hard water and things like that. So they were looking at it for that, but somebody chose to test it out in other ways and put it on some plants and got a result. And so that was in the 70s when this all first happened. Then when I was home farming, I can remember people coming up with all kinds of ingenious devices on how do you apply this to weeds without killing the crop. So there were weed wicks and wipers and things like that that you could, like, go over a soybean field and touch the taller weeds and hope to get them without harming the soybean crop. And then in the 90s, the company decided to work on making crops resistant to Roundup. And they found altered enzymes in bacteria. So they moved those genes in first into soybeans and later into corn. And so people started using Roundup in a big way. Animals in general do not have the key enzyme that is in plants, which glyphosate affects. So compared to some older compounds, certainly it can be considered safer. You know, the rate at which it breaks down in the soil, which is pretty rapid, that or it binds very tightly to the soil, which inactivates it too. So, yeah, it had a lot of features that made the regulators and the toxicologists pretty confident to say that it was a better product. Economics is always an important consideration in any kind of farming practice. Monsanto's patent on glyphosate has expired. And since that time, foreign suppliers have been selling glyphosate, a generic form. But certainly its spectrum of activity, its comparative cost, its ease of use, the way that it allowed farmers to work crops and minimize tillage or even go no-till, a lot of farmers have chosen to use it. You know, that heavy use has had, what should I say, unanticipated consequences. Over time, life finds a way. So there have been weeds that have developed resistance. They have either produced more enzyme so they could avoid the inhibition from the glyphosate, or they've managed to alter the key enzyme that Roundup binds to and blocks in the plant's metabolism so that they can avoid the effects. And as a result of that, people are using more. They apply it more. They apply it more frequently, multiple passes on a field in order to get higher amounts on those plants. It's just that kind of typically of our American culture, we tend to love things to death and overuse things. And, you know, being from a center that focuses on sustainable agriculture practices, I would look upon glyphosate as one of our examples of unsustainable use. Just as we're seeing rootworms become resistant to BT corn and things like that in relatively short time of just, you know, a couple decades, two, three decades, we've taken a technology and we've kind of spoiled it for ourselves in terms of resistant weeds and overuse and maybe some unintended environmental consequences that we're still trying to figure out. A lot of those things are showing up in the literature, and there's papers on one side, you know, saying one thing, and papers on the other side saying something else. And I know for a lot of people this is very frustrating, that it doesn't come out as a clear-cut answer. But about all I can say is welcome to the world of science. You oftentimes get conflicting results and confusing results, and it takes time to do multiple experiments, multiple replications before it becomes clear as to what the answer is. So the one thing I think that we need to consider in agriculture, we already are talking about a term called judicious use in the use of antibiotics in the medical field, but also in the livestock industry. Judicious use of antibiotics for control of disease and so on. I think we need to transfer that term also to some of our other farm chemicals. I haven't heard that term. Maybe I missed it in other circles, but I haven't heard the use of the term judicious use with regards to Roundup and other field chemicals. But I think we're approaching a time where that's going to become important.
That was Mark Rasmussen, director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. He was talking about glyphosate, or Roundup, as its most famous commercial formulation is known. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And now we have a guest in the studio.
That's right, Gail. I met our guest, Bob Streit, at one of the lectures on GMOs on campus this spring. He was asking the presenter some interesting questions about soil microbiota. Bob earned a master's in agronomy. He's a certified crop advisor, a certified professional crop specialist, and he has been working in this field for 39 years, including 11 years where he doubled up and spent his winters in Brazil advising farmers down there. He's seen a lot of corn and soy fields, and lately he has been advising his clients to steer clear of glyphosate and glyphosate-resistant crops, or at least use it judiciously. So welcome to the show, Bob.
Glad to be here this morning.
So later in the show, just to remind folks, we'll be talking to the director of research at the Iowa Soybean Association about current research on glyphosate. And if we have time, we'll hear a segment from my conversation earlier this week with Bob Kramer, a soil biologist who has studied glyphosate's effect on the rhizosphere. And I believe you know Bob Kramer?
Very well.
Yeah. So, Bob, I have to ask you, was Mark Rasmussen's discussion a kind of walk down memory lane for you? Surely you were there in those heady days in the 90s when the combination of Roundup-ready soybeans and the no-till system was the best solution to a lot of issues, from soil erosion to declining organic matter content. Do you remember recommending those systems?
Yeah, very well, because basically before that time, farmers had a tremendous difficulty in controlling weeds in soybean fields. There were maybe 12 weeds that caused major problems, and oftentimes you couldn't see the soybean plants for the weeds. So when this product came along, it was almost a miracle. It was silver bullet. People could spray it, and it made a lot of farmers look awfully good without spending much time or dollars in controlling those weeds. But like Mark said, it became overused, and also there was probably the mistaken sales point that when it hit the soil, it was inactivated. And if you're a word sleuth, you would actually notice, well, if it was inactivated, where did it go to? We found out later through work in Germany that the half-life on it, depending on pH and clay content, could be from 8 to 22 years. But yes, it was heady days, and it helped conserve the soil in that a lot of farmers could get into no-till and use this as a complete weed control. But as Mark said, nature usually finds a way around something, and we've got a lot of resistant weeds and weed control problems nowadays.
Was the adoption of that technology, the Roundup Ready GMOs, similar in South America, where you do consulting as well?
It was very quick to be adopted after permission was given by the importing countries. But in my role as consultant to quite a few farmers and some businesses, we have to look at the economic side, and rule number one in business is, what does the customer want? And the customer is always right. If these other countries are finding maybe some health care issues and they're saying, we do not want this anymore because we are finding residues in our grain samples based on testing by the diagnostic labs in Germany and the Netherlands, I think it's smart as business people to listen to them and deliver the product that they're asking for.
Is it mostly Brazil that you work in, or Argentina as well?
Well, I get it. I've gotten into Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Chile. Yeah, really in Argentina, they probably had more reason to utilize glyphosate on a wide scale because they do have Johnson grass there, which is an 8 to 10 foot tall perennial grass that will get so thick you really can't walk through it. So they were using it primarily as a method of cleaning and killing the Johnson grass that was in their pastures that they were converting to row crops.
So you've talked about the customer demand, and we talked earlier about how farmers in Iowa can get more for their crop if they go non-GMO. Are there other reasons why you've recommended farmers to go a different way?
There's a lot of books out there, a lot of literature right now, which is dealing with the chelation part of the glyphosate activity.
That's where it binds to the positively charged cations.
Phrase. Chelation is a Latin word for claw.
Okay.
So it basically ties it up. It surrounds it.
But two things in the soil.
Two things in the soil and also the minerals that are present in the plant that okay. serve the role as allowing the plant's immune system to function. And we're finding out that in plants, if you're missing the copper, the boron, and zinc, they're going to get diseased. Just like in humans, if you're missing those same minerals, you can't have the P450 cytochrome system, which is your basic immune function. The other thing also, it was patented as a EPS synthase inhibitor, which is not quite correct. They patented, they said humans don't have this system, so
right.
the product can't hurt it. But in about the last 3 to 5 years, there's been a big emphasis by microbiologists and medical people realizing that we have 2 to 5 pounds of bacteria in our gut, that this bacteria number actually outnumbers the number of cells we have in our body. And the pesticide we're talking about is harmful to those microbes. If we kill them off, we lose 70% of our immune system right there.
So it has antimicrobial properties, and those can come back to bite us because we are sort of the soil in which these microbes live.
I've heard the phrase before that as humans we have to recognize we're basically a host for bacteria.
Yeah, we're a bacterial culture.
Now, when you talk about the plants having their defenses altered by the chelation, that would make you think that there's a lot of diseased crop out there if they're being subjected to Roundup and having all of their minerals tied up. Is that what you're finding when you go around and look at people's fields?
Yes. Say 15 years ago, basically cornfield stayed completely green until the frost came. And nowadays, we've been seeing the corn crop across the Midwest die 4 to 6 weeks early. So the insightful observer of agronomists and farmers are actually asking the question, what's going on? Why is it happening like this? And it's pretty easy to have a job now as a plant pathologist or a fungicide salesman because the need is so great. And typically we've had extremely healthy corn plants because there are a lot of genes that can be brought in to insert into the plants and fight off these diseases. Those things aren't working anymore.
So did this trend of the less healthy crops that die early, that brown early, did that happen right away as soon as the Roundup Ready systems got in place, or is it something that has sort of gradually worsened as these systems become more ingrained?
We have to take a very broad perspective on this, and I'd say what that is a lot of the research on micronutrients was done in the period from 1955 to 1965. And those people that did the work finally wrote the textbooks, and they said and summed it up in about 1965. And they said, farmers, you don't have to worry very much about the supply of micronutrients in the soil. You've got enough for 40 years. Well, if you had 40 years on the 1965, that puts you about 2005. And where you really begin to see this explosion of, say, corn diseases, 2009, and then in soybeans, 2010, which we saw a huge explosion in a new disease called sudden death in an area from Omaha to Beltsville, Maryland. And then we've seen that disease be a major factor as far as soybean yields in 2010, and then again 2014. We really did not see it in 2011, 12, and 13 because the conditions were not proper for it to occur.
So there's a lot of different factors then that influence even how the presence of glyphosate plays out. as someone who doesn't know that much about this topic specifically, it seems like the original claims were that glyphosate would not stay in the soil long, that it would be either bound up in the soil or it would be broken down, and so it wouldn't be dangerous in all these other ways or have these other kinds of outcomes. And now we're finding, A, that's not happening as reliably as it was originally believed to happen, and that is having a whole array of unintended consequences in different places at different times. And that has led you to kind of change your thinking on whether this is should be recommended wholesale. Is that an accurate summary?
Yeah. We're seeing right now that when they do accurate testing down to 2.5 part per billion and they pick it up in foods such as Fruit Loops, Gerber baby food, in mother's breast milk, and also in the Pedisure and the fluids that are given through intravenous tubes into young oncology patients, 5 and 6 years old, at high levels up to 176 part per billion, we started to think maybe there's some problems with it.
Okay. Well, we're getting into the effects on human health. Inevitably, I suppose, with any pesticide, why don't we get back to the plant health, the soil, and hear from Robert Kramer. He's a soil biologist at the USDA's Agricultural Research Service. He retired from the USDA last year. He's down in Missouri at the University of Missouri.
Well, you know, we really got interested in this when the transgenic genetically engineered crops were introduced, especially the ones that are resistant to glyphosate, because glyphosate, having been around for, you know, since the late 70s, early 80s, we knew that it is a systemic type chemical. In other words, once it's applied to a plant, it moves throughout the plant, and a lot of it is translocated to the roots, and it will find its way into the soil as well. So I think it was 1997, we were looking at this with some of the first Roundup Ready soybeans, and we were looking at the roots and evaluating the microbial community on the roots, and we observed throughout the season that the roots that of soybean that had received glyphosate were really loaded up with fungi, primarily Fusarium and Rhizoctonia and Phytophthora. And, you know, it's a serious problem because they're potential root pathogens and could potentially cause disease. And we thought that was quite curious, and we continued doing that over the years, and it was the same observation that we made every year, regardless of variety, regardless of soil. The glyphosate causes the roots to become somewhat, I would say, leaky. They would leak out a lot more sugars and other carbohydrates and even some amino acids. And this tended to stimulate these fungi in the rhizosphere and cause them to colonize the root system quite a bit higher than what we would see without the glyphosate. And it would also cause an imbalance in the microbial community in the rhizosphere as well. You know, some of the more beneficial microorganisms would not be in as high a composition as they were, say, if glyphosate was not being used.
And so just to clarify again, sometimes the glyphosate can come through the plant itself, through the roots into the soil?
Oh, yes. It will make its way into that rhizosphere. You know, it may not be immobilized or absorbed immediately onto the soil particles and onto the organic matter. So it's free. It can move around in the soil water. It can affect microbes. And so just imagine the scenario. The glyphosate is released from the root. And then if the glyphosate is not taken out of the picture anytime soon, it could still be in the soil water. And the plant may take that up again. And we've seen this in controlled studies in our greenhouse studies, that when that happens, those root tips become very damaged. They even become necrotic or blackened root tips, and they're not doing anything. They're not able to take up water, so it's reducing. You know, it's kind of a very subtle death of the roots if this happens. So there's a lot of things going on there. You know, the root pathogens And the glyphosate itself is having some impact on the overall root structure of these plants.
So that was Robert Kramer from the USDA's Agricultural Research Service. He said he conducted 10 years of those studies and found the same thing every year, fungi colonizing the roots excessively in glyphosate-treated crops. And so, again, I asked him, you know, does this then result in extra disease in the field? And this was his response.
That's our hypothesis, that would happen. And in fact, sometimes you can see that there is less root density, which means that the plant is not very efficient in taking up water. We've also related this to lower nodulation by the bacteria that fix nitrogen for soybeans. So there's lower nitrogen fixation activity. But, you know, in all our years, we have not been able to really correlate this to an outright disease development. Let's say, for instance, like the sudden death syndrome that's caused by fusarium. We've been able to identify that particular fungus, but it's not as prevalent in our assays as some of the other species that we see in soybean and corn, for that matter. So it's more than likely affecting the overall vigor of the plant because these fusarium are colonizing the root system. I think that's one of the reasons why we haven't seen a huge increase in yields of the genetically engineered varieties compared to non-genetically engineered varieties, because the use of glyphosate is still allowing that plant to produce, but it's probably inhibiting its overall potential. And a lot of folks will take our research, you know, they will say something like, reports indicate that glyphosate may have an adverse effect and increased severity of diseases in soybean. Well, we've never said that. You know, we say that there is a definitely a potential for increased disease. And it just so happens that where we've been researching most of this here in Missouri, you know, we really haven't seen that.
Okay. Bob Kramer from the USDA, formerly of the USDA Agricultural Research Service. Bob Streit, agriculture consultant here in the studio. What is your response to what we just heard?
Bob is a very good scientist. One thing I probably should add to it, in the basic plant path courses, what we learn is there's what we might call a plant disease triangle. And that says to have a disease to occur, you need a host plant that is susceptible, you need the right environment, and then you need the pathogen present. So apparently in 2010, 2014, we had the right environment in the soil. And the pathogen then is a Fusarium vulgiforma, which is a species that is observed when the symptoms appear.
That's the sudden death Fusarium.
Yes.
And that's a fungus.
Correct. And what we think is going on is that if you're deficient in the nutrients needed for the immune system, you've got a very susceptible plant. And what we know then is the great-grandfather of most of the varieties out there was an extremely susceptible variety, which was the chosen one because it accepted the viral fragments and viral promoter that accompany the insertion of the gene from the bacteria to make it resistant to the herbicide.
That's interesting, yeah. So have you seen sudden death syndrome in fields?
I like to fly with a few friends that have airplanes. In 2010, it was sea to shining sea. And I'd say in fields that should have been perfectly green yet on August 10th, in central, north central Iowa, there were probably 85% of the acres that were brown instead of being green. Yield losses, I'd say 50 to 60%, 70% in fields. This year, again, in an area that covered a lot of southwest Iowa.
You mean 2014?
Yeah, 2014. But very, very heavy from Ottumwa, Iowa, to Columbia, Missouri, east to Springfield, Illinois. It was horrible. Again, a lot of 50 and 60% yield losses.
So how can I ask, how are scientists or how are the farmers making sense of that? Are they – obviously they're seeing those crop losses. Are they associating it with some – with Roundup or not?
In most cases, when I was called in, I asked, are you getting any good explanations from any extension people, mm-hmm. from any seed people, from any retailer or fertilizer people? And they said everybody just shrugged their shoulders and said, we don't know.
Okay.
And if you're farming out there, we hope someone can provide answers. Mm-hmm. And I brought along a copy of a picture a friend of mine took. I've got some just about like it, but his was a little bit better. And what it shows is a field in 2010 down in southern Illinois. And the whole field is yellow from SDS. We saw the yellowish leaves with this scald on it. We found the purple snot on the roots. But there's some pockmarked circles through the field that are right around the power poles that are sitting along the edge of the field. And anyone that runs a sprayer knows you don't want to catch the pole with a boom because you might do a lot of damage that will have to be repaired and could be costly. But wherever they missed with the sprayer, the plants are perfectly green, and there will probably be a 20 bushel an acre yield difference between the unsprayed area and the sprayed area.
That's a pretty dramatic photo. He has it in the studio, and it's a pretty dramatic difference. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have on the line with us Ed Anderson, the Senior Research Director of Iowa Soybean Association, and they recently conducted a study, or sponsored a study, I should say, of this sudden death syndrome caused by fungus, Fusarium fungus. Are you there, Ed?
Yes, I am, Greta.
And this particular study, there were some researchers from Iowa State involved, Darren Mueller, and found that... Well, why don't you tell me what it found?
All right. Well, I'll try and give a quick summary of that. But first, if I may, appreciate the opportunity. It's good to talk with you and happy to be here this morning. Appreciate the opportunity to represent the Iowa Soybean Association and the many farmer members and soybean and corn farmers that we partner with across the state, because as we all know, corn-soybean rotations are critical to our agricultural economy in Iowa, and so we focus on soybeans, but we're always interested in the rotation. And so you're correct, we did fund a project with Darren Mueller and his colleagues to, again, look at the interactions between glyphosate and the SDS fungus. But please, for the benefit of your listeners, realize that with soybean checkoff dollars, not only across Iowa, but across the Midwest and through the United Soybean Board, Iowa farmers are well represented with their research dollars, and the Iowa Soybean Association, Iowa State University, and many other soybean associations and universities across the country are doing their very best to expend soybean checkoff dollars to look at not only diseases like SDS, but other production practices and soil health and water quality, nutrient management for soybeans. So appreciate the opportunity. And with that said, the study by Dr. Mueller and his colleagues is one of many. This study was done in response to a need, genuine questions about whether glyphosate does or does not have an impact on diseases, and in this case, SDS in particular. But it was also done in response to some studies that had maybe not been quite as broad and robust in analyzing the question. And so these collaborators set out to really conduct a broad study across a lot of geographies, a lot of soil types, a lot of climates, and a lot of agricultural production practices. And the question that has been out there for a long time is, what's the impact of glyphosate on plant health and fungal pathogens and insects and everything else in the environment, both in the soil and in the foliar tissues. And so this study undertook a careful look at what happens with glyphosate and SDS in areas where there's an SDS incidence. And the basic finding was that there was no statistically significant impact, negative impact on plant health or increase in the severity of SDS due to the application of glyphosate on Roundup resistant soybeans. So that's kind of the takeaway from this particular study.
And this study was conducted in the years 2011, 12, and 13. Am I correct?
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
Over 3 years. And Bob was just telling us that those 3 years were years that the fungus, the sudden death syndrome fungus, was not particularly acute.
I think Bob's referring to 2010 and 2014 probably.
Yeah.
The years where across broad areas of the Midwest, we certainly did see an increased incidence of SDS. Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
So that was unlucky as in terms of the research. But what are the implications for your members? What have you told them? Go ahead and use Roundup and Roundup Ready systems?
Well, the general broad statement to that is, and this is going to sound pretty wishy-washy and like we're sitting on the fence, but there's a reason for what I'm about to say. So the Iowa Soybean Association partners with farmers, we partner with universities, and we partner with a lot of companies, both in the seed industry and the crop protection industry. So we collect, we do a lot of studies, we support and fund a lot of studies, and we collect and analyze and report a lot of data and information. We are very open and transparent with that, but we try very hard not to make recommendations so as not to give the appearance of being aligned with or supporting or endorsing any company or any product another.
Sure. So, I should have spoken of glyphosate and glyphosate resistant.
Right. So with that said, as kind of the general disclaimer, realize that we have a lot of challenges and concerns with herbicides, glyphosate being one of them, in just general use and management, right? So the Iowa Soybean Association is part of the national effort. Simply, in a nutshell, it reminds farmers we need to be taking a very holistic look at how we manage weeds and diseases and insects in our cropping systems. And we need to take a very integrated approach and consider all types of different options for control. In this case, Roundup, as you know, there's been a significant uptick in the number of herbicide-resistant weeds, and whether there is or is not a consistent positive or negative impact on diseases and other things that are going on in that plant's environment, we're always championing an approach that says integrate your chemistry, integrate your traits, integrate your management practices in a way to best manage and be the best steward of your cropping systems as you can. So are we telling farmers everything's fine, go ahead and use glyphosate regardless of what the impact is or is not on SDS or herbicide-resistant weeds or anything like that? No, we're telling them here's the data, as best we are aware, our own data and others, and you should be a good steward of your chemistries, traits, and cropping systems, and you need to make the decision what's best on your soil types, your disease pressure situations, and your cropping system.
So it sounds like earlier we had Mark Rasmussen, and he spoke of judicious use of herbicides. Is that something that you would echo?
Absolutely. That's an important part of this integrated strategy. So I don't think any scientist, and for that matter, any farmer who's looking at the long-term success of his or her operation is going to be indiscriminate in the types of pesticides that they apply. Judicious use of everything. I mean, and that can apply to just how many seeds you put in the ground, right? So, yep.
And you mentioned that you're conducting workshops in Iowa for pesticide resistance management.
Well, to this point, so as we talked yesterday briefly, the workshop portion of that hasn't occurred. Now, the Iowa Soybean Association and Iowa State University conduct a lot of wintertime off-season workshops around the state. And we're in constant communication with our farmer members and farmers who are not members of the ISA. We're offering them information and data to help them in making their own decisions on their cropping systems and their management practices. But specific to the pesticide resistance issues, Iowa State and IDALS are really teamed up to lead that effort, and many farmer organizations are participating. And those discussions around developing a strategic plan for Iowa farmers to really look at and consider as they work to manage all of their pests and pesticide resistance issues, that's still in development. So that's not being that's not out there yet for farmers to have. But there's a lot of good information, and I would certainly put a plug in for the many CCAs across the state of Iowa. I think that agronomists and CCAs and extension and outreach folks, for the most part, do an exceptional job of collecting data and information from all types of studies, both public and private, and do their best to get that information into the hands of farmers to help them make decisions.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask, we're really running out of time here, but I want to ask my other guest, Bob Streit, certified crop advisor, what he recommend, what kind of systems he recommends in place of glyphosate and glyphosate resistant crops, and see if you guys agree on that.
Well, I think as farmers move forward in this growing season, we have to realize they're not going to move off their number one herbicide in a short period of time, unless something, a black swan event comes up, like all of a sudden China saying we don't want them anymore. But what we're saying is, if the pesticide was patented as a metal chelator, realize there is truth in the fact that there are different minerals needed to maintain plant health that are tied up, no longer available, the plant's going to be more susceptible. So I'm urging farmers to maybe do more tissue testing, do more sap analysis if that is present. If they're not doing it, learn about it, make use of it, and then supplement the plants with post-applied micronutrient mixes and keep the minerals present and available to the plant that are needed to maintain a functioning immune system. If they're still needing to plant some soybeans, look at some of the biological products such as a Trichoderma that will help fight the biological battle on the roots below the soil. We like products like Generate and Micromix that also supply different minerals that help the plant grow a bigger, more expansive, deeper, healthy root system, because we're trying to keep the root healthy so the above-ground portion of the plant can stay healthy and as productive and profitable as possible.
Okay. Ed Anderson, your response to Bob Streit.
Well, I certainly don't disagree with Bob, and I think his introductory statement was probably pivotal, and that is farmers are not going to move away anytime soon unless there are major herbicide-resistant weed issues or market directions, such as he mentioned with China. They're not going to move away from glyphosate, and I wouldn't expect them to personally. And I feel that, based on its safety and effectiveness overall, I think glyphosate is still an extremely effective and useful herbicide. But as we talked earlier, and as you asked earlier about this integrated approach, we would recommend that farmers be aware of all of the data and all of the product offerings. Bob didn't mention, and I'm not going to mention the company because that's not what I do, but there are some new seed treatments now that have demonstrated pretty darn good effectiveness against SDS, and there may be some improved protection against other pathogens and just some general plant promotion opportunities. So farmers certainly need to be listening to their agronomists, their CCAs. There's a lot of data that we have at the Iowa Soybean Association. We have a website that contains a database where farmers can go in, anybody can go in, and really search on different studies that have been done over the years, look at the data that's been generated for all kinds of fungicide trials, plant populations, row spacing, insecticides, fertility, all kinds of things.
Go ahead. Address the micronutrient issue.
Micronutrient comment that Bob made is, I think, a really good one. And that's another area where there's a lot of somewhat conflicting data and information out there. Dr. Antonio Malarino at Iowa State has done soybean checkoff funded research for a number of years and on micronutrients. And I think I would encourage farmers to really jump into some of that information as well, especially in this time of depressed commodity prices. Farmers, as they always are, but I think now this current year and probably next year, are going to be stressed more and more financially, and they're going to need to really consider all of their inputs and all of their investments against what the return is going to be. So there's a lot of information. There's a lot of conflict in the information, unfortunately. But I think with input from agronomists and CCAs and the Iowa Soybean Association, I think farmers have a lot of good resources to help them in making decisions.
Okay, we've got to cut it off there. Thank you so much for your time, Ed Anderson, Senior Research Director of Iowa Soybean Association. I want to thank Bob Streit for his contributions this morning as well. And we have a few announcements. One of the announcements is the death of B.B. King. And in tribute, let's play a short piece by him. Unfortunately, now the king is gone. Goodbye, BB. In the studio, we have Sue Dinsdale. She's the director of Iowa Citizen Action Network, one of the groups sponsoring tomorrow's Working Families Summit at Sheman Auditorium starting at 10 o'clock. Sue, quickly, tell us what this event is about tomorrow.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for letting me come in today and talk about it. We, a large group of different organizations, many labor unions, Iowa Federation of Labor, Communication Workers, AFSCME, ISEA, and then a lot of community groups, including my groups, Iowa Citizen Action Network and the Iowa Alliance for Retired Americans, along with many others, have been meeting regularly since the beginning of the year. And we are kind of tired of these summits that we hear about and see on the news, and we want to have a summit that's really for working families. And so we have invited people to come to Ames and join together and learn about issues that are really important to working families. We're excited. We have over 500 people registered, almost 600 for the summit, which is huge. And I think what it shows is a real thirst for knowledge about these issues, especially around raising wages, protecting civil rights, and ultimately making work family friendly.
And Robert Reich is your keynote speaker?
Robert Reich is our keynote speaker, and we're very excited about that. Anyone who knows who he is knows that this is an issue that's near and dear to his heart. He most recently had a movie come out called Inequality for All, and we actually were able to do a screening of that movie last year and had been in touch with him throughout following that. And when we told him about the Working Family Summit, he instantly cleared his schedule and made time to come to Iowa. So I would encourage anyone, even if you can't come for the whole day, to come and listen to Robert Reich.
And he'll be speaking at about 3 o'clock? Or
somewhere around there, so mid-afternoon.
In Scheman Auditorium.
Scheman Auditorium.
And you don't need to be registered to?
Actually, if you want lunch, we needed to have people pre-register, which is why, because we are providing a free lunch. And we are asking people that come to bring donations to MICA, Mid-Iowa Community Action. And that's really the only cost of the day is just your time and come on in.
Okay, but registration is now closed.
Right.
So if you want to come, maybe bring a bag lunch or you can just come to the 3 o'clock event.
Yep.
And is there a website? We can have the link to it on our website?
Most of our information is housed on the Progress Iowa website, so it's progressiwa.org.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sue Dinsdale.
You're
sorry
welcome.
We don't have longer.
No.
We'll be covering the event and
That's
report
great.
On it Monday.
Okay.
All right. And here is Belinda with an update on music.
Hello. This is Belinda Merritt, and I have the live music for May 15th through the 21st. On Friday, May 15th, New Trick will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler Street. Opus Taylor will be at Snooze Hill Winery, 2183 320th Street, Madrid, from 6:30 until 9:30 p.m. Saturday, May 16th, the Marshall County Hangmen will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler Street. Barioki will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. On Sunday, May 17th, According to Hoyle, will be at Snooze Hill Winery, 2183 320th Street, Madrid, from 2 until 5 o'clock p.m. On Thursday, May 21st, Government and Dr. Murdoch will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. That's all I have for this week. Thank you.
We also wanted to let people know about Cycle Cinema Night on Friday, May 22nd. That's next Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. You can be part of an Ames Bicycle Coalition-sponsored bike ride from Memorial Union to KHOI, where there will be informational and interesting films about cycling, and the films are at 7. So either meet at Memorial Union at 6 to ride and then be here at 7 for the bicycle-related films. More information on our website or the Ames Bicycle Coalition website.
And that's next Saturday, not this coming one.
Friday, May 22nd.
Friday, May 22nd. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've spent most of the hour talking about glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup. We had in the studio with us Bob Streit, certified crop advisor and certified professional crop specialist for 39 years. We spoke by phone with Ed Anderson, director of research at the Iowa Soybean Association. We also heard from Mark Rasmussen, director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, and Robert Kramer, a soil biologist, formerly for the USDA's Agricultural Research Service down in Missouri. Thank you to all those guests for your thoughtful contributions. We also spoke with Sue Dinsdale of Iowa Citizen Action Network about tomorrow's Working Families Summit in Ames.
And relevant links to those organizations and guest contact information will be on our website later today, and you can also listen to the show. Our web address is khoifm.org. If you like the show, tell your friends.
We've been your hosts, Greta Anderson and Gail Seiler. Richard Morrison has been our trustee engineer. Our theme song is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878 or through our website. Or drop by the studio at 410 Douglas Avenue. News tips are welcome.
As always, your role as a listener as well as your contributions and pledges are what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening and see you again on the radio.